The Khashoggi murder mystery continues today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. An Israeli software company may have provided Saudi Arabia with spyware to track smartphones. Did Jamal Khashoggi pay the price?
Although the software is marketed for anti-terror and criminal investigations and sold exclusively to governments, the governments are using them to monitor journalists, human rights defenders, and so on.
Plus, a Dutch man sues to change his age on his birth certificate. He says he feels like he's younger.
It's a feeling. It's nothing else. It's a feeling about yourself.
I like that reasoning, but did a Dutch court buy the argument? Also, a ceremony to honor a top women's soccer player is tainted by a sexist remark. The stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you along today. Top officials in Washington and Riyadh have tried their best to close the books on the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, but the questions surrounding the killing just keep coming. CIA Director Gina Haspel was on Capitol Hill, fielding some of them today. We're going to start off today tackling one of those questions ourselves. Did Saudi officials track Khashoggi via his phone communications? Omar Abdulaziz thinks so. He's a friend of Khashoggi's who lives in Montreal. Abdulaziz is suing an Israeli company called NSO Group. He says NSO supplied the spyware that the Saudi government used to hack his cell phone and, as he told the CBC, his conversations with Khashoggi.
Yes, Mr. Jamal Khashoggi, and I'm sorry to say that, he was contacting me via my cell phone, the one that was hacked. So I'm pretty sure that they were listening to the interviews, that they were reading the conversations that we had.
NSO says the lawsuit is baseless, but the Citizen Lab, a University of Toronto project that investigates digital espionage, they've concluded with high confidence that the Saudi government did target Abdulaziz's phone. Ron Diebert is the director of the Citizen Lab. So the technology here is a little complicated. Let's start there. How does this Pegasus spyware work?
Essentially, the spyware works by taking advantage of what are flaws in the code of devices that aren't even known to the manufacturers of those devices. So in this case, we're talking about Apple and its iPhone, which is a very secure product. The operators of the spyware typically send a text message or an email that contains a link. They try to trick the recipient into clicking on the link. Once they click, the spyware is activated silently. And it can read all the emails, it could activate the camera, the microphone, effectively turning the device into an espionage tool in the pocket of a target.
Did Omar Abdulaziz come to you and state his suspicions? I mean, how did you and the Citizen Lab get involved?
No, actually, it was the other way around. It's quite fascinating. Over the course of a couple of years, using a variety of quite complicated technical means, we've been tracking the infrastructure of NSO Group, the vendor that sells Pegasus spyware, and we were able to see that there were live infections in the Quebec region. So we actually set out to try to identify who the victim would be. Omar is a very prominent person on YouTube and Twitter. He's a critic of the Saudi regime. So he was one of the people that we suspected might be targeted. When we met him, we searched through his text messages, and he received a text message with a fake DHL courier notification that contained one of these exploit links. Coincidentally, Omar had earlier in the day ordered something off of Amazon. So when we examined his messages, we could see that he had opened the message, and that was probably enough to infect his phone. And then we also matched his movements. We could see infections coming in from two different internet service providers, and these matched exactly the movements of Omar Abdulaziz.
I mean, it's cloak and dagger stuff, but can your organization, the Citizen Lab, reasonably conclude that the hack then contributed to Jamal Khashoggi's death?
Well, interestingly, our report was published on October 1st, and the very next day, Khashoggi was murdered. On that morning, when Khashoggi had disappeared, Omar sent me a text saying he was very concerned because he and Khashoggi had been planning, and that's the first I'd heard about their relationship. So that means that the Saudi operators would have been able to intercept all of their plans, all of their encrypted messages, all of their phone calls, etc. So it's certain that they knew what they were planning. Whether or not that contributed specifically to the decision to murder Khashoggi is something we'd have to ask Mohammed bin Salman and senior Saudi officials.
How did the Saudis get the software? Was it as simple as just buying it from NSO Group?
This is part of the reason that we at Citizen Lab have been monitoring this particular company and other companies like them. The market for this type of very powerful commercial spyware is largely unregulated and prone to abuse. So companies like NSO Group don't really care who their clients are or how their clients use and abuse the software, although they claim otherwise. And what we have been showing in our research is, although the software is marketed for anti-terror and criminal investigations and sold exclusively to governments, governments are using them to monitor journalists, human rights defenders, and so on. Prior to our report on Omar Abdulaziz, we confirmed an Amnesty International report that one of their researchers and a Saudi dissident based in the UK were similarly targeted with the same spyware.
What precautions are Saudi activists taking?
Well, there's naturally a lot of alarm in the Saudi human rights community based on this reporting. We've been receiving a lot of inquiries from people who are concerned about text messages they received. We are able to verify whether people have been targeted based on the text messages they receive and specifically the links, which we can say with confidence are connected to NSO Group. So we published a list of all of those domains and have encouraged Saudi activists and others to check against those domains to see whether their phone has been targeted or infected in the past. And then beyond that, there's just, you know, good common sense precautions not to click on links that are contained in emails or attachments from people that you don't trust or expect.
And Omar Abdulaziz himself, apparently he was invited to speak with officials at the Saudi consulate in Canada. He declined. What precautions is he taking for his own safety?
I'm not sure exactly what he's doing, but certainly that was chilling to hear that Omar was visited by emissaries of Saudi Arabia in the summer and encouraged to visit the embassy in Canada, knowing what happened to Jamal Khashoggi. You know, I will say that Omar is a very brave person for coming forward and being so transparent about what happened to him. He said he feels very guilty that the surveillance on his phone could have led to what happened to Khashoggi. Mm-hmm. But he nonetheless is speaking about it in order to raise awareness, which I think is both very important and very laudable.
Ron Deber, the director of the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
The probe into Khashoggi's death was front and center in Congress today. As I mentioned earlier, CIA Director Gina Haspel was there to brief key lawmakers. One of them was Senator Lindsey Graham. He came out of the meeting saying he had high confidence the Saudi crown prince knew in advance about the killing.
There's not a smoking gun, there's a smoking saw. You have to be willfully blind not to come to the conclusion that this was orchestrated and organized by people in under the command of MBS, and that he was intricately involved in the demise of Mr. Khashoggi.
At the same time, lawmakers are awaiting updates on Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Russian election meddling. A sentencing recommendation for former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, for example, could offer a clue as to Mueller's strategy. Susan Hennessy is editor of the Lawfare website at the Brookings Institution. I asked her exactly what Flynn had admitted to lying about.
Michael Flynn admitted to lying to federal investigators about the contents of his conversation with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, specifically whether or not they discussed sanctions. So there's still a lot of open questions about who might have directed Flynn to make that call and much larger sort of ramifications. But his core crime is his misrepresentations to federal investigators.
Then there are President Trump's recent tweets, and I know lawyers like you have been paying close attention to them. In one of them, the president says his former fixer, Michael Cohen, should serve a full and complete sentence. And in another tweet, he praised his longtime advisor, Roger Stone, saying Stone would not be strong-armed by an out-of-control prosecutor to lie about Trump. I mean, it really sounds like Trump is saying people who cooperate are rats and those who don't cooperate are his friends. How legally problematic are those tweets for the president?
Yeah, so both are potentially legally problematic in somewhat different ways. I think the more significant legal question or potentially more problematic issue for the president is the tweet regarding Roger Stone. The federal witnessing tampering statutes make it a crime to attempt to corruptly persuade in order to influence, delay, or withhold testimony. And I do think that there is a reasonable read that Trump's tweets are, in fact, attempting to do precisely that.
Isn't that called a bribe?
So it depends on what is being offered in exchange. President Trump has offered a pretty consistent message here, which is that he says people who don't cooperate, who don't flip, as he calls it, he commends them. He says that they've stayed strong. Now, I don't think it rises to the level of a bribe unless he's offering something in exchange. You know, one of the questions specifically as it arose related to Paul Manafort and similar tweets that he made in the past was whether or not the president was essentially dangling the promise of a pardon in exchange for somebody not cooperating. Mm. Now, if that was the case, I do think that would raise serious questions about whether or not it implicated federal witness tampering laws as related to bribery.
Susan, we keep hearing these tantalizing rumors that Robert Mueller's report is going to drop soon or before the end of the year. But can we just be clear on this? Is it really going to be one single report and then the chips will fall where they may? I mean, isn't the Mueller report kind of dropping one chapter at a time?
Yeah, so the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has said again and again that the special counsel's office is going to speak through indictments. It's going to speak through its court filings and has made clear that that's where they're going to make the statements. Now, it does appear that Robert Mueller is planning some kind of final report. That report won't necessarily become public. He will give that report to the Attorney General or Acting Attorney General, and that person will make the determination about whether or not to send that to Congress, and Congress will decide whether or not to make it public. You know, the other big question is what that report will actually contain. We might see something that looks like the Starr report that sets out a lot of legal conclusions and has a tremendous amount of narrative detail, or we might see something that's a lot more spare, something that looks like the Watergate roadmap in which, you know, prosecutors do not offer legal conclusions. They just set forth the evidence as they understand it and hand it over to Congress and say, you do with this what you will.
You're referring there to the Ken Starr report during the Clinton presidency, of course.
Precisely.
Susan Hennessy, the editor of Lawfare at the Brookings Institution. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
One more story before the break. A historic moment this week for soccer. For decades, there's been a prize given out each year called the Ballon d'Or, the Golden Ball. It's handed out by a French soccer magazine with a flashy ceremony in Paris, and it goes to the year's best player in the world. Until this year, it was only awarded to men. There just wasn't a Ballon d'Or for women. Until, as I said, this year.
Mesdames et messieurs, Ada Hegerberg!
The first ever women's Ballon d'Or went to Ada Hegerberg, a Norwegian striker who plays professionally in France. The ceremony seemed to be going as planned, with the winner's inspirational speech translated in real time for the French-speaking audience.
To young girls
en m'adressant
all over the world,
aux jeunes filles partout
please,
dans le monde,
believe in yourself.
S'il vous plaît,
merci
les filles,
beaucoup.
Croyez
bon
en vous.
But then this. A famous DJ, Martin Solveig, with a question none of the male winners have ever been asked. We're going to play some music. Can you twerk?
Est-ce que tu sais twerker?
Non.
What? The men on stage were laughing, but Hegerberg herself, not one bit. As you heard there, she said, no, she didn't twerk. And if you can translate her facial expression, it said to me, not this again. On social media, the DJ got multiple takedowns for a sexist comment, and in the room, most of the players, men and women, looked dumbfounded, if not plain outraged. The DJ soon went online to apologize, though that hasn't stopped the criticism over what he said. Ada Hegerberg tried not to let any of that get in the way of this long-awaited historic moment for women's soccer. She spoke with reporters after the ceremony.
I mean, I think this is a fantastic day for women's football in general. It's historical. It's a big step forward for women's football to have this award, and that's why you need to take the moment to really cherish it and show the importance of pushing younger girls to pursue their dreams.
Norway's Ada Hegerberg, the first ever women's Ballon d'Or winner, one of the highest awards in world soccer, speaking there in Paris after a historic but somewhat tainted award ceremony last night. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Before we all began focusing on the migrant caravans heading north from Central America, many of the headlines were about migrants getting detained at the border. But after detention, how do they make ends meet until they can get a hearing? A group of school students from San Antonio is trying to make that post-detention life a little easier. They're collecting blankets for immigrant families. We called up two of the students on FaceTime so they could tell us about what they've done. Sixth graders Misael Solis and Emma Garrido. They attend the Advanced Learning Academy in San Antonio. Hello, Misael and Emma.
Hi.
Hi.
It's Marco here. Very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
So what a thoughtful way to help these people out. How did this all happen?
Well, our teacher, Miss Hudson, noticed this over the summer that families were being detained and separated at the border, and we wanted to find a way to help these families.
And so we partnered with an immigration organization called Raices, and it's starting to get colder here. So we thought that a blanket drive would be a good idea because when they get out of the detention centers, they just have like little sweatshirts or something like that.
Yeah. How many blankets were you able to collect and who from the community donated?
This is Misael. We have received almost 200 blankets and we have delivered 72. But we are receiving donations from all over our community and even a lady from Pennsylvania who saw our story online and wanted to help. And so she sent in almost like 20 blankets.
Wow, that's fantastic. So you're getting support from really all over the country.
Yes.
Tell me about handing the blankets out. You go to the bus station in San Antonio, is that right?
We give them to the Raices people and they deliver them to these families that are just arriving from the detention centers.
So you've been down to the bus station?
I have, yes. Yeah. It's really comforting to be able to have something to wrap around you after going through these experiences.
When you see pictures of migrants walking to the U.S. or you hear stories about them wanting to find peace and safety and jobs in America, what crosses your mind? What do you think about?
This is Misael, and I just think it's really important to help these people because they're just trying to have a better life and help their families. And so we need to welcome that because they're escaping these violent situations and they're not all horrible people.
This is Emma. A lot of times people tend to focus on the people in our country and homeless people. I mean, they definitely do matter, but we have to understand that immigrants are people too and that they still need the same resources that we do.
So Misael and Emma, do you have any classmates who came to the United States, like some of these migrants, you know, on foot with little money in their pocket? And did you talk to them about this project and how do they feel about it?
This is Misael, and they just thought it was good to be helping out.
This is Emma, and they also shared stories of their parents being deported.
From what I heard, Misael, this is not the first time you've worked with Raices. Can you tell me about something you did in second grade?
Yes, in second grade, one of my father's friends was working for Raices, and so they were making an animated video based on the drawings of these children who's being raided by ICE. And so I volunteered to do the voiceover for these videos, and it was very eye-opening because this was the first time I had heard of this happening, and it inspired me to help these people.
You know, one thing I've learned talking with both of you is that we here in the U.S. are very lucky to be born where we're born. And you seem to have figured out that it's really important to help out people who are not lucky. So thanks both of you for what you're doing. And Emma, thank you for your time. Misael, thanks for your time. I guess it's time to go back to class.
Thank you for wanting to interview us.
We cover a lot of stories on the world about borders that are difficult to cross. This next story, though, is about a border that's becoming easier to cross, for some people anyway. Last week, Pakistan broke ground on a new border corridor. This passage is designed to allow Sikhs who live in India to cross into Pakistan without a visa so they can visit one of their holiest sites. It's the temple where Guru Nanak, the founder of Sikhism, is supposed to have died. My guest, Baljeet Singh, is the president of the Sikh Temple in Westboro, Massachusetts, and this is a big deal for him.
It's very important because being a Sikh, you always want to see your roots. In school, we've been reading about the stories related to Guru Nanak and his teachings. So I believe that it's very important for me as a person to be able to go there and see the shrine.
So I know you grew up very close to this holy site, but I want to get a better sense of what it means, because this site that will be opened up in the Kartarpur corridor, it's called Gurdwara Darbar Sahib Kartarpur. Am I getting that right?
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
So what happened there, and why is this site so important for Sikhs around the world?
So Guruji spent the last 18 years of his life in Kartarpur, and he was giving his teachings out to people from that place. And the three main pillars of the Sikhism, Kirt Karni, which means earn your living, Naam Japna, meditate on God, and Vanchakna, and you know, share your earnings with others. That's the teachings that were given there.
So it sounds like this is really important, like it is the intellectual beating heart of Sikhism.
Yes, it is.
Tell me about your own personal story, because I know, as I said earlier, you grew up not far from this holy site, but you could never actually visit it. What did the site and the Gurdwara mean to you, being where you were so close, but yet kind of so far? Were you even aware that it was there?
Yes, I was always aware about the Gurdwara because we had read all the stories and we had seen pictures and videos on this. So I've been preparing to go there in 2016. All my family were ready to go when the tensions flare up between India and Pakistan, and we had to cancel. That was a big disappointment for me and my family. And we were just hoping that the relationship between the countries will normalize sometime soon in the future. And then we should be able to go and visit these places, because there are three important shrines related to Guru Nanak Dev Ji, and there's one related to Guru Ram Das Ji, which is the fourth master for Sikhs in Pakistan. So we were thinking that soon we have to do it, but there was no immediate plans. And now with this thing opening up, we can do two things together: go visit India and other shrines, and also be able to visit Kartarpur Sahib at least.
And when do you think you're going to make the pilgrimage yourself?
It's going to be not next year, but a year after.
You've already kind of like marked out the date. You're looking at the future very seriously.
We try to go to India and, you know, visit all these places. When we go there, we don't have much family there, but we still want to go visit the most important religious places for us in India.
I mean, it is kind of rare to hear good news about relations between India and Pakistan. Where do you think this is all headed, especially kind of from in the political context?
I think by opening up the borders, there is a chance that people will see each other. Because if you see the history of the country, more than anything else, it's a mistrust between the two countries. And when people will go and visit these places and open up to each other, I believe that's a good start for a better future. Being neighbors in both nuclear powers, it's no one's interest the countries go on another war, you know, fight another war. So I think it will open up people's hearts and minds so that they can be trusting each other, and hopefully that will normalize relationships.
Baljeet Singh, the president of the Sikh Temple in Westboro, Massachusetts, thanks very much for coming in. Great to meet you.
Thank you for having me here.
I'm Marco Werman. Just ahead on The World, Canada grapples with the legacy of a founding father.
You can't just compartmentalize a person and be like, well, he was this and that. I mean, no. You have to look at him as an entirety. You can't just pick and choose the parts that you like about him and the parts that you don't.
Canada's monument debate, coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The French government today did a U-turn on its plan to raise gas taxes. Its reversal comes in response to more than a week of widespread protests, some of them violent. If French President Emmanuel Macron thought that the reversal would slow down the protests, he's wrong.
We were left without transportation because of the protest. So I came home by walk and it took me an hour. So I literally just arrived.
That would be the transportation today in the city of Toulouse, not Paris. This is nationwide in France. We just heard there from Rimsara Alouane, who studies law at the University of Toulouse. She says the protests are showing no signs of dying down.
They're actually growing, and actually students in high school in Toulouse are also joining the movement. The protests are getting bigger, and unfortunately today a high school was also put in fire. So it's not stopping.
What are the students saying as their reasons for joining this protest?
They are mainly complaining, and as well as university students, by the way.
Yeah.
They are complaining about Macron's reform of the baccalaureate that caused a lot of problems this summer, and which left a lot of students without a place at university.
So what started out as protests against this gas tax imposed by President Macron is now kind of sucking up people in high school who want to get their degree, their baccalaureate, and graduate. So it sounds like it's not just a single issue anymore.
Oh, absolutely not. People just can't live in France anymore. Things are getting tough. People, you know, the line of poverty in France has increased. People just can't make it anymore. So the rise of the price of gas was just the cherry on top of the cake.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, because yesterday we spoke with one of the organizers of the Yellow Vest, the Gilets Jaunes. He lives in southeast France and kind of organizes there. His name is Romaric Giacomino. And I asked him whether this is a political protest and how broad their issues are. Here's what he said.
Non, on n'est pas un groupe politique. La plainte des Gilets Jaunes, c'est pas l'impôt sur le pétrole. L'impôt sur le pétrole, c'est l'impôt de trop.
So Giacomino told me, as you heard there, they're not a political group, and also that the gas tax, that was just the tip of the iceberg. They have other wider concerns, echoing what you said about the growing cost of living in France.
Even if people are really tired about the mess the protests are causing, people generally support the movement. Now, is it a political movement? I think it started as a people's movement, still is, but I'm afraid we can't escape that it will become political. And especially with the instrumentalization of the Gilets Jaunes movement by the far right, especially, who is taking this opportunity to move forward with their agenda.
I mean, the far right has taken advantage of it. Hasn't the far left also taken advantage of the Yellow Vest movement?
Yes, of course. I should have mentioned it. The far right and the far left. And, you know, with the rise of populism in France, in Europe, and in the West in general, we are having elections coming. We are having a European election coming in May. This is a perfect time for these parties to make sure to have their voice heard as well. And the Yellow Vest movement is a perfect opportunity for that.
Let me turn again to Romaric Giacomino, the Yellow Vest organizer I spoke with yesterday, because he also is talking about how he's struggling to make ends meet.
Je vous disais que je travaille à Marseille. Désormais, du jour, je travaille pour l'État, je suis enseignant. L'État, du jour au lendemain, m'a dit...
So Giacomino is telling me that he works in Marseille as a public school teacher. He said that one day he heard from the government that his salary would not change. And then the next day, he says that he has to pay 400 euros more in gas taxes at the end of each month. I mean, 400 euros, that's more than almost $500. I can see why he's mad.
Marco, I can talk about my own experience. I just received the same kind of letter. My mother received this letter as well, that we have to pay an extra 400 euro. Gas and electricity, actually. So I completely understand that gentleman.
So how are French reacting today to the government's announcement that they're going to put the gas tax on pause for 6 months?
People are not really satisfied with the answer. They still don't believe the government. Like, okay, you are doing that, but we need more. Again, it's not just about this tax. It's really about the cost of life and also the disparity between the wealthier and the poorer. And also how taxes are not really well distributed. We have a great system that basically the current government is not using properly. So what people are asking is literally what is in our motto, equality. And how do you manage to implement equality by having a just and fair tax system?
What does all this mean for President Macron, who swept to power as a centrist?
This is the first big crisis Macron is facing. And unfortunately, I think the French are just really tired with his let them eat cake kind of attitude. For like 2 weeks, Macron barely said anything besides condemning violence that occurred during the protest, but nothing was done. Even the government was pretty silent about it. Oh, you know, it's a French thing. You go protest, you take on the street, and then you go back home. You know, protesting is part of our cultural heritage, whatever. But now I think the government is worried. I think elections are coming, so they better be worried. I think they had no choice but to make a gesture, even a token gesture, to show that they were willing to cooperate. But I don't think that right now people are buying it.
Sounds like these protests are going to get bigger before they get smaller.
Maybe things will calm down during the holidays, but January 1st is coming. And usually January for French people is a synonym of prices increasing, like, for example, the stamp or the baguette. So it will grow again. It will grow faster. And it's no good sign for the current government.
Rimsara Alouane studies law at the University of Toulouse. Thanks very much, Rimsara.
Thank you again for having me. I appreciate it.
Remember the start of these protests, a tax on fuel. The protests in France and backtracking by President Macron show how hard it can be for governments to implement even small changes meant to help cut climate pollution. There is a downside to every decision, and without careful planning, people can be hurt in the short term by policies meant to deal with big, long-term challenges. We've seen that here in the U.S. as well. Workers in fossil fuel industries like coal mining pushed back hard against Obama administration climate policies and helped elect Donald Trump, who's now undoing a lot of those policies. Shivan Kartha works on just these kind of challenges at the Stockholm Environment Institute. He focuses on climate equity and policy. He's based here in Massachusetts. What did Macron do wrong with these new fuel taxes, and what could he have done differently?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that this uprising was triggered by his fuel tax. But I think it's really important to realize that that's not what it's about at its root. It's about many people in France and around the world really feeling like an underclass, that their standard of living is slipping away, that their lifestyle is increasingly precarious. And so they're pointing now to things not just like his fuel tax, but also to his weakening of labor protections. And they're asking to have the minimum wage raised. And then, as we just heard, issues around public education. So it goes well beyond climate. But if Macron wants to reset his climate policies, he'll need to think bigger than climate. He'll need to think about reversing these trends toward inequality and insecurity that are spurring this overbearing sense of insecurity.
I mean, it's hard to imagine undoing all the kind of consequences of neoliberal policy for the past few decades. I mean, right now, given all those consequences that you just talked about, what are the principles government should follow to just soften the blows of policies aimed at cutting carbon pollution?
Well, I think that one of the absolute key principles is to recognize that as much as we would like to talk about there being huge net benefits in the long term to climate policy and job gains, and, you know, this is definitely a better path for our economy and our world to take, there are going to be some people who have less to gain from a transition away from fossil fuels. So I think what that means is that the principles of an effective climate transition are to not just think about, oh, maybe some retraining for laid off workers in coal mines and a few other industries, but think much more about broad investment in education. Make people feel like they're trained for our changing economy. Let's not think just in terms of a few regulations to make sure that fossil fuel companies' pensions don't go broke and leave coal miners high and dry, but think about a strengthened and expanded social security system so that everybody can feel more secure, less threatened by change, period.
But in the short term, I mean, I think about Dunkirk in France, which has recently started free bus service for everybody, and it's been a game changer. Of course, it takes resources to do that, but I'm scratching my head here in the United States wondering why they didn't do that in more cities in France instead of a gas tax.
That's an excellent example. And it's an example of a policy that, one, it makes sense, and two, it does benefit people who need to rely on public transit. And I think that there are many such ways that we can think of climate policy in that kind of a progressive way. You know, we have progressive taxation. We don't put the bulk of the burden on those who are least able to shoulder it. We have to keep in mind that well more than half of the world's wealth is owned by the richest 10%. And similarly, more than half the world's emissions are caused by the wealthiest 10%. And we need to think about climate policies in a way that takes the realities of those huge inequalities into account.
Shivan Kartha with the Stockholm Environment Institute, speaking with us from his office here in Massachusetts. Thanks very much, Shivan.
My pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
If you've ever found yourself telling a little white lie about your age, you might feel some sympathy for Emil Ratelband. He's a 69-year-old man who went to court in the Netherlands to ask for his age to be officially lowered by 20 years. He says it's because he feels he's being discriminated against, also because he feels 49, not 69. Well, the court in the Dutch city of Arnhem did not agree. We got the plaintiff himself, Mr. Ratelband, on the line to explain what he's talking about.
Well, every 2 years I have a check for my doctor, and he told me that the last 20 years my body has not changed at all. Everything is still the same. My bone structure is the same. And so 2 years ago he told me, your biological age actually is 40 years, Mr. Ratelband.
All right.
And then I heard from somebody that he changed his family name. I said, nah, you cannot change your family name. He said, yeah, well, I'm ashamed of the things my father did, and I don't want to carry his name anymore. So he went to the town hall, and he just changed his name.
Okay. I understand what you're trying to say, that there are all sorts of ways that people can change.
Yeah,
but, I mean,
correct.
The doctor told you biologically you're 49, but let's face it, chronologically, you're 69. There's no way you can change that.
That's what you'll say, but the doctors actually tell me nowadays that I'm completely right with that, because every person who comes to him and he has a sickness, and it has nothing to do with the chronological age. It has to do with the biological age. It's a feeling. It's nothing else.
Mr. Ratelband, I also understand you wanted to improve your dating prospects. Is that really what's going on?
No, that's not true. No. That's a big mistake, because it was this. I tell you the truth and how it went. It was like this. I give an interview to a guy, and when I finished the interview, he said, this is great what you're doing, because I'm on Tinder. I get the wrong woman, because the algorithm gives me old woman, because I'm 58. So when I can lower my age till 38, then the algorithm will give me different woman. And so he made up in the interview that it was my story, but it was his story. So I'm not on Tinder. I don't need Tinder, because I'm a very attractive guy, and the woman love me because I'm the man I am.
The court ruled against you. Were you surprised?
I was not surprised, but I was very glad, because my lawyer and me, we built up a strategy to have a victory. We first had to collect the opinion of the judge, so we could build up in the next stage, in the appeal, a better defense.
The judge said that granting the request, if they were to do it, it would cause all kinds of legal problems by effectively erasing 20 years of events. I mean, what would happen to qualifications or a driver's license? Yeah. What do you say to that?
There's one of the things he said, and it's very good. We are very glad with that, because he said that my individual wish was nothing compared to the price the society has to pay. And so this gives us a very good mean to act in a different way the next time in higher court, because there are many, many cases in which the individual got the right, and that was paid by the majority of the people.
I mean, you yourself said this is how you feel. You feel 49.
Yes, I feel 49. Yes,
feelings are not.
And I can prove that by the doctor's declaration.
Fair enough. But feelings are not facts. So I'm wondering if, in a court of law, will your feelings ever triumph over facts?
No, but it's not. It's like this, that the time has changed. In the past, like 50 years ago, we didn't talk about emotions or feelings. But now we are in a different society, and our evolutions has increased, of course. And now we're speaking about feelings and emotions, and we want to change.
Would you give up your pension if you were 20 years younger?
Yes. I told the judge also, I give up my pension, and I'm going to pay another 20 years for the next pension.
So, Mr. Ratelband, I have to ask you, after this disappointing ruling for you, how...
No, I'm not disappointed at all.
You're not.
Because I told my lawyer I'm very satisfied with it, because we lost the battle. We are going to win the war.
How old do you feel today?
I still feel 42, 43.
Mr. Ratelband, I certainly feel your energy, and long may you live.
Okay, thank you very much. Hope to hear you again. Bye-bye.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Protests break out over a statue honoring a man who some say shouldn't be honored anymore, while others say his legacy is part of our nation's history. It's a story we've seen unfold many times here in the U.S. This next version of the story, though, is happening in Canada. Sir John A. Macdonald is celebrated as Canada's founding father, but it turns out his legacy is darker than many Canadians like to remember. Here's Emily Russell with that story.
Peter Gower says you can think of Sir John A. Macdonald this way, like two legendary American presidents rolled into one.
It's a Washington in terms of saying we're going to become independent. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how many battles we lose or what happens. In a way, though, it's also an Abraham Lincoln in saying, no, this is the only way to go about things.
We're in Kingston, Ontario, a university town northwest of the New York border. And in a park on the edge of downtown is a 20-foot-tall bronze statue of Macdonald. He looks strong and stern, kind of how you'd expect a founding father to look. Gower is in the park with fellow Kingston Historical Society member Warren Everett. Everett says Macdonald is the reason Canada exists.
People have to ask themselves a question, what would this place be if there had not been a Sir John A. Macdonald?
Macdonald led the country to independence from Britain in 1867. He was Canada's first prime minister, in office for nearly 20 years. There are streets and schools named after Macdonald, his face on Canada's $10 bill. But now there's this.
It has been a raw debate in this country in recent months. The place of Sir John A. Macdonald in Canadian history. His legacy as Canada's first prime minister is tremendous, but that legacy, we know, includes the creation of the residential school system.
Under Macdonald's leadership, Indigenous children were taken from their homes and families and forced into state-sponsored boarding schools run by Christian missionaries. Investigations found that children were sexually and physically abused, punished for speaking their native language.
My name is Natasha Sturritt. I'm Armiskin Cree from Alberta, and I grew up in the Cornwall-Aquasosne area.
Sturritt's grandmother was sent to a residential school. Sitting in a coffee shop in downtown Kingston, Sturritt says people need to look more clearly at Macdonald and his legacy.
You can't just compartmentalize a person and be like, well, he was this and that. I mean, no. You have to look at him as an entirety. You can't just pick and choose the parts that you like about him and the parts that you don't.
In 2015, a comprehensive report by Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission found residential schools carried out widespread cultural genocide, shining a light on Macdonald's tainted legacy. But for some, the report's finding doesn't go far enough.
They defined it as cultural genocide because that was what was going to make white Canadians comfortable and okay with it.
Krista Flute is Lakota. She grew up here in Kingston.
But under international law, it is defined as genocide. Not cultural genocide, just genocide. And Canadians need to grip that.
More than 150,000 Indigenous children were sent to residential schools since Macdonald's time. An estimated 6,000 children died in the system. That history has inspired protests and vandalism of Macdonald statues all across Canada, like in Montreal in August.
The statue of Canada's first prime minister splattered with red paint. Cleaning crews are already here to help start cleaning things up.
At West in the city of Victoria, local officials took down Macdonald's statue outside City Hall this summer. It's expected to be moved to another public space. Here in Kingston, the debate is even more complicated. This is where Macdonald grew up and got into politics. He's kind of like a hometown hero. So it was a big deal when Paul 48 decided to erase Macdonald's name from his downtown pub.
We said, let's just change the name slightly. So rather than Sir John's Public House, it became the Public House.
A stereotypical Canadian response, polite with an emphasis on keeping the peace. But 48 says this debate over Macdonald's legacy has gotten as heated as the ones in the U.S.
I was receiving death threats. You know, overnight there would be people who would phone and leave messages on the answering service, saying, look out, watch your back, you're gonna be a goner kind of thing.
People are angry on both sides. If you take a statue down or remove Macdonald's name, some here see that as a betrayal of Canada's history. If you leave it up, keep everything as is, others will tell you that's an insult, a cover-up. There are people, though, looking for a middle ground.
I'm Jennifer Campbell. I'm the manager of cultural heritage for the city of Kingston.
The city is deciding what to do with that big bronze statue. They've been taking comments and planning community forums. Campbell says from what they've heard, most people want the statue to stay, but they want Macdonald's story told more honestly.
I would say the majority really do seem to be calling for add to the history and better tell it, as opposed to anyone saying, don't touch anything and never make a change.
So plaques and other signage that tell Macdonald's entire story, including his treatment of Canada's Indigenous. As for Natasha Sturrett, whose grandmother was sent to a residential school, she says the compromise is a cop-out.
So on the surface, Canada wants to seem like it's working with Indigenous people. Canada wants to seem like, you know, it recognizes Indigenous sovereignty and nationhood and things like that. But we know different.
The impact of McDonald's policies, Sturrett says, is still unfolding. There are higher rates of poverty and lower rates of employment among Canada's Indigenous. Battles continue over land rights and access to natural resources. And the trauma of the residential schools is still fresh. The last one didn't close until 1996. For The World, Emily Russell, Kingston, Ontario.
One last thing before we go. A couple of weeks ago, on Thanksgiving, I spoke with jazz singer Magos Herrera from Mexico. She recently came out with an album called Dreamers with the string quartet Brooklyn Rider. That was before we heard about a very cool idea she and the quartet made for the song Balderrama. It's a 360-degree video shot in their studio. So it actually allows you to pan around the studio where they're performing. And as you pan, the sound follows you. Pan to one side, you hear more of Mago singing. Go the other way, and the focus is on Brooklyn Rider's sound. Because our show broadcasts in mono, you get both together here on the radio.
Sale cantando la noche desde lo de Valderrama. Sale cantando la noche desde lo de
Magos Herrera and Brooklyn Rider together in mono, but you really need to see the video and pan around the studio to get the full stereo experience. It's a lot of fun, I promise. You select the sound mix based on what you're looking at. We've got the video exclusively for the moment on theworld.org. Check it out. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
Dele chispear la guitarra. Los hierros solito brote del alba. ¿Dónde iremos a parar si se apaga Valderrama? Se apaga Valderrama.
PRI, Public Radio International.